have set aside $2 million of our new appropriation for projects on that list. Update on the ECP program, how have we been doing with it? We've had two rounds of ECP, Expedited Conservation Project review. We do it every 2 months. The first time we did it, we had five applications for a total of $128,000 in grants. Not as much as we had expected, not as much as we had hoped for. This latest round, which we just completed in November, we had six applications, so we're going in the right direction. Still, again, not as much interest as we had wanted to. The total amount we funded was $170,000. So we've awarded 11 grants worth about $300,000 through that expedited process. We still have $1.7 million available. We'll be doing three more review processes. This is an open application cycle, so grantees can access applications at any time. And we'll be doing reviews in January, March, and May. The good thing about the ECP program or project review process is that we do have 21 uncompleted applications in the system right now. 13 of them have budgets associated with them, however, they have not completed them fully. And those budgets total $370,000 to today. So we do have the interest. One of the things that we know with the cycle of conservation enhancement projects is that the winter is a good planning period for project sponsors. So we're hoping that those 21 plus others start to come in with that project list. We do, of the 21 uncompleted applications, we have two new entities. That's something that Councilmember Rawl was interested in. How many new entities are we impacting every cycle? And as we go through the history of the program, I'll say how many new entities we have per round that we've seen. But 10 of the 21 unfinished applications are new entities that haven't been part of the ECP program in the past. So we're impacting new entities. Any question on the funding package? We can talk about those now. Otherwise, I'm going to go on to talk about the history of the program. We've had 4 years of funding. We've had 160 grants that we're currently managing. Of those 160 grants, 102 have been to nonprofit organizations, and 58 have been to governmental entities. We've had 35 acquisitions, 62 enhancements, and 63 restorations. The total acreage we've impacted is just under 114,000 acres. Total grant funds awarded is $15.7 million, and that's all we have available for grants, with the exception of the ECP $1.7 million that we have available. Of the $15.7 million we've given out, $4.8 has been spent. Now, that includes the grants that we just awarded, $3.5 million in grants we just awarded. So if you take that $3.5 million that we're right now processing those grants, we've spent 40% of our awarded dollars. Let me rephrase that. Our grantees have spent 40% of the money they have available to them. Those grantees have pledged over $4.8 million in match, or 30% match on our funds. Completed grants, I'll go through these quickly. The Laws of Nine, that was our first appropriation. We gave out 32 grants. 21 of them are completed. In Laws of Ten, we've awarded 48 grants. 11 of them are now closed. And then, of course, the latest Laws of 2011 and 2012, we haven't closed any grants because they're brand new. Now I get to the entity analysis, again, something that Councilmember Rawl, the liaison to the Small Grants Program, has requested that we take a look at, is how many unique organizations have come into our program every year. And this is of the awarded applications, so these are grantees currently. Of course, the first year we had 24 grants. They were all unique to the program, believe it or not, all brand new. In Laws of 10, the second year, We had 30 unique organizations. 21 of them were brand new to the program. The next year, in laws of 2011, we have 44 unique organizations, so we're growing the number of organizations involved. 26 of them were new to the program. And in this latest round, we've had 20 unique organizations, and 9 of them brand new to the program. That's a summary of what we have for you today, and I'll stand for questions.
Questions? I have a quick...
Go ahead.
I'm just curious what the Agassiz Cattail Project is, number 351. What are we doing about the cattails?
We have a number of projects that we've awarded that remove cattails for the wetlands. Our grants, our natural resources specialist is not with us today, who knows these projects inside and out.
Okay.
We apologize. Jessica's been here 5 weeks, and sometimes I don't get down to the level of detail that I want to in these projects. Jamie Gangaware would be able to answer any questions about these projects. But my understanding of the Agassiz wetland, the cattail projects, is we are moving cattails from the wetland. We're trying some things that are in cases, I don't know if this is a project or not, that are unique in cattail removal. We know it's an uphill battle when we remove cattails that there will be encroachment. But we are trying some things with these grants that hopefully will show us some long-standing benefit.
I know the Delta Marsh had a huge flood last year, which took out half their cattails because they were 4 feet underwater for 6 months. Mm-hmm. Let's flood them all. Jim?
Okay, Pete, on that point, there's no place we can go to see what all these projects are. We have to call Jamie to find out what these projects are.
Currently, is there... Go ahead.
There's a summary online. It's available.
And how detailed is it? Just a couple sentences? Or?
It's a significant paragraph for each one.
Okay. And as far as the projects we funded back in 10 and 11 that aren't completed, why aren't they completed, and who monitors that?
Mr. Chair, members, our grants program staff monitor those. Some of them are not completed because they are recent awards. We had old money that was left because of projects not being suitable enough for funding in the past that we just awarded. We used $1 million of old funds in this latest round in November that we just awarded. That's one of the reasons why they're not completed. Another one might be that these projects aren't ready for implementation. The grantees may not be ready to roll on them and set up the contractors. A lot of it is done by contract. Who's monitoring it? Our grant staff is monitoring it, Jessica and Jamie, and we are in the process of hiring a third that would be able to go out and monitor these projects.
Thank you. Wes?
Peter, could you just briefly describe the on the second page, the Friends of Detroit Lakes wetlands, the tile breaks and ditch blocks? What are you breaking the tile and blocking the ditches, or are you repairing the tile and opening the ditches?
Councilmember Benson, Chair, Mr. Chair. We believe it's breaking up the tiles and blocking up for wetland enhancement.
Okay, second question. Peter, how much of an effort has been made as far as going around the state and promoting the program? Are you actively involved in that?
Mr. Chair, members, we are. Ms. Gangaware has just traveled last week. Actually, Ms. Lee as well traveled and spoke at a conference. We're open to those invites from any of you who want us to show up at an event with possible grantees. We also self-promote. We'll be at the January Roundtable. We'll be at a number of we went to the Soil and Water Conservation District's meeting, and we're open to any events that you may have with possible grantees as well.
Other questions?
check with Scott.
Scott, do you have any questions or comments?
I do have a few comments, no questions. I can I have been in pretty constant contact with Mr. Squire, and he has been very efficient in program updates and how things have been going. I have to give our grants administrator kind of my kudos for the first time in the existence of our small grants program, we were able to hand out all of the available funding in one round. To me, that's a pretty good sign of success. We are going to stay kind of in some current contact as to how long we're going to allow some of those expedited project list dollars to hang out there before they might be reallocated, to try to get a better sense of how many of those types of projects we might have. But we're going to make sure, and I will report back to the council, you know, when, if and when those dollars kind of get redirected as we see how that program evolves. So those dollars will not lay out there endlessly until they are put to work. But I think that the program is running now about as good as I could expect it to be. I'm thrilled to death by the number of entities that we are seeing involved in that program. You know, I said that the more people that can touch a dedicated funding dollar and see that dollar work in their community or in their area, the more support for that amendment we will generate and garner over the state. And so I hope to use, and I hope that we're successful in using the small grants program to continue to reach out to more and more individual entities. And so I think our administrator is doing a very good job, and I am very satisfied with how that program's operating at this point.
Great. I just had one last question, which is how you determine sort of the priority of acquisition when you get program or projects in. What makes you decide it's a good one, a bad one, this one's more important than the next one?
Mr. Chair, that's a pretty big question, because acquisition is such a large component of what we do, not just in the CPL program, but overall. And it has to be in that overall plan. It has to be a strategic acquisition. It has to be approved through the land manager itself. It has to be approved in the priority. It has to be with a cooperative partner, of course, in this case. So there's a number of factors with approving the acquisition. It has to be strategic, and it has to be within the larger plan.
So that would be for land that was eventually going to the department. What about land that somebody's buying to hold?
I don't know that the Conservation Partner Legacy Program has funded an acquisition outside the WMA program. I can check on that for you, and I'll get that answer back to you.
Jim?
Pete, one more question. Is there any place we can go to find out which projects haven't been completed?
Mr. Chair, Councilmember Cox, the applications that have not been completed in the system, is what you're looking for, or not been funded?
Projects that we've allocated money that have not been completed.
Yes, we can get you that list.
Okay, but okay.
It's in our database. We don't have anything public on that. We'd be in a myriad of constantly updating our website with that. So we'd have to go into our database and run the report for you.
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Pete, you might consider putting that list in the 6-month reports.
Thank you for the suggestion.
Any other questions? Great. Thanks for coming in, and I'm delighted to hear things are going well.
Thank you.
It's been a long road to get to this point. You guys have done a lot of work, so thank you very much. Next, we have an update on restoration evaluations.
Mr. Johnson's not here yet.
We don't have an update on restoration evaluations. Can we do a discussion on PRIM maps? Let's do a discussion on PRIM maps.
And we can do it. This is as a request from one of the council members in the last meeting. The question is, how do people find out about the acquisitions that the fund has made? Can we get them, make sure that they get on the prim maps? So with that,
go ahead. Introduce yourself to for the tape.
Mr. Chair, council members, my name is Tim Lesh, and I am the GIS manager with Minute Services at the Department of Natural Resources. And I've worked for the DNR for 20-plus years and have been in the business of mapping out the natural resources and other resources that we have throughout the state. I've been involved peripherally with the PRIM mapping program, and the request today was to come and give an update on the PRIM project and how the DNR is using data and other information to display where people can recreate. What you have in front of you is a presentation that I gave to departmental senior managers about a year and a half ago to give them an update of the program and where it was at and what changes I felt needed to be made to move the program forward. So I'd like to go through that and just kind of get you all an update as well. Minnesotans have invested heavily in our state through the Legacy Program. They are investing in water quality and recreation, hunting and fishing access, and you know it's a good bill of money. And disseminating recreation information is important because if they don't know where to recreate, if the citizens and the visitors to the state don't know where they can recreate, they're never going to get there, and we're never really going to see the return on investment that we should be seeing. Our customers and consumers are far more sophisticated now than they were back in the day when we were printing paper maps, folding them up. There's cell phones, smartphones, tablets, and the internet. Most people are connected now and can get on and access information that way. And they also have a high set of expectations for us to deliver materials that are useful, that are intuitive, and get them what they need. So a little history. The PRIM program, or Public Recreation Information Maps, were developed and distributed, or have been developed and distributed by the DNR for about, I think about 25 years. When I was a young man in college in 85, I applied for a job to work with the PRIM program. I unfortunately didn't get it, but that is about when the PRIM program started, late 70s, early 80s. The original funding was through the general fund allocation within the DNR, through proceeds from map sales, and through the professional services account at the department. And it was really a pretty popular and informative product, and they were sold throughout the state in various gas stations, in sporting goods stores, in resorts and other locations for anywhere from $4 to the current price right now, which is about $6. But unfortunately, the program has languished. The lack of attention and focus by the department through staff turnover. The champion of the project retired about 10 years ago, and key staff have moved on, cartographers and such. And really, through attrition, the program is non-existent at this point. We haven't printed a map in over 4 years. The demand is very low. We've sold approximately $3,500 in maps annually for the past couple of years. It's cost much more to store and distribute and update those maps, and we just have not had the funds to do so. About 3 years ago, the last cartographer in the PRIM program was transferred into my section, and he retired in 6 months after that. And with him leaving, much of the institutional knowledge about PRIM has gone away. And so I felt like we needed to do something about that, and I started pushing on a new idea to update and rejuvenate the PRIM program. So the plan was really, the pitch to the DNR senior managers was that the PRIM program needs to be rejuvenated. Maybe it's not called PRIM anymore. Maybe it's called something else. but more targeted around things like online access and printing, print-on-demand services. We find vendors to print and ship customized map products on demand so that we don't have to maintain an inventory of products. Rather, we print them when they need them and have the vendor do the fulfillment. We're working with Minnesota State Industries right now. They're storing our maps in their warehouse. They also have printers. They can take care of this. They can do this particular print-on-demand map products. And the data changes, or the information changes, on a constant basis. So doing the maps or providing the maps in this on-demand format ensures that the map, the people who get them or order them, get the most up-to-date products. We're also interested in GPS loadable maps. There are sportsmen and women out there are using these handheld GPS devices, and we want to be able to put data on these products and make it available to them so that they can put them on their snowmobiles, on their ATVs, in their boats, and things like that. Now, this is really a cooperative type of venture, because while the DNR manages many recreational lands, there are other people or organizations out there that also do that, including the federal government, counties, local government units, the Met Council, the University of Minnesota. And what we've pushed at the DNR is for a position to coordinate this activity, to develop products, and then to provide a flexible environment to serve online access via a website, for example, or through a print-on-demand service, or GPS loadable maps, or more recently, mobile devices like iPhones and Android devices and tablets. So, for example, online access, where can I? It's an internet browser-based access to recreation information, maps, tables, other pertinent information about the recreation resource. We'd like to give the users a lot of options, not confined by traditional paper products. We want the users to be able to target their own recreational interests to the maps, zoom in to produce high detail, or zoom out to produce low detail. And if they can create a PDF file and download it to their computer, they can print it off at their printer for free. The GPS loadable maps, personal GPS device sales are booming. Digital GPS maps are a growing market. We routinely have companies like Garmin and Lowrance download data from the DNR Data Deli and include it in their map products. They're easy to load and use. They're not as flexible as online maps, but they have their place because these GPS devices are really pretty rugged. And again, we like to be able to provide our constituents with the ability to pick out what they're interested in and the area that they're interested in and download it and install it on their maps. Print-on-demand, I think, is a really nice idea because in my opinion, as a hunter and I'm running around in my truck, I like to have a piece of paper to write on. So being able to download a map to print it on your local PC or to put it on a thumb drive and take it to FedEx Express or wherever they do copying and print it on a large plotter, that would be up to the public what they wanted to do in that regard. And then mobile devices are really booming. We have made some forays into the mobile application area. We have the Lake Finder, which is very popular, is now a downloadable application that people can load on iPhones, iPads, and Android cell phones, although there's a lot of opportunity as well. So I think this is the future, and I think that we can be ready, and really we are ready. And I kind of came up with this idea to call it the You Are Here application, to access the GPS on the cell phone and show you where you were, where you are, and where public lands are. And we're actually working on that application right now. It's in prototype. We have it on a few conservation officer cell phones right now, and they're running around the state testing it out for us. So that, in a nutshell, is where we are at with the the update or the rejuvenation of the PRIM program. I am happy to say that it has been funded. It has been funded on an annual basis out of the general funds from the DNR, and we're actively in the stage of developing the project and defining the outputs. So this is really, I think, an opportune time to have a discussion about what kinds of information would be useful for folks, because I personally feel that, you know, we need to make this stuff available. It needs to be up to date, readily accessible in a variety of forms. The last slide that I have in this presentation, I added yesterday out of a request to talk about some of the issues related to showing private lands on publicly available maps. There's really nothing illegal about it. Ownership and boundary data is really public information. You can already go out to the courthouses, you can go online, and you can see ownership patterns across the state. Plat books, Goodhue County, for example. I do a lot of hunting down there, and they have a website you can go to, display the map, ownership information. It's just like a digital plat map, and it's very useful. But I think there's a balance that needs to be made. In some cases, there's an issue of sensitivity to the landowner's privacy. And in some cases, there is an opinion that mapping private lands will actually deter people from getting into programs. But there is also a need to display private lands that are open to public access, like walking areas and forest conservation easements. So a little bit of a discussion that needs to be had.
Okay, great. Any questions? Jim?
Well, Mr. Lex, when this project is completed, how will the public find out about this and how to access?
I don't think this project will ever be completed. I think it's an ongoing program that changes and evolves and adapts. But part of our project plan is to put together a marketing strategy that would be coordinated through the department's Office of Communications and Outreach. We would push this at various events like Pheasants Forever banquet that's coming up this winter. I've been asked to have staff there to show some of the technology that the DNR has available to sports people out there. Outdoor News. I'm sure there would be a press release.
So if I wanted to know today what's available, how would I do that?
You would go to the DNR website, and there's a maps section on that website that has a variety of online maps as well as information on how to get at PRIM maps. But currently that's really the only area that they're being promoted.
Les?
What is the website link?
It is www.mmdnr.gov/maps.
Run that by one more time.
www.mmdnr.gov/maps. And that's kind of a page, you know. We try to make our maps simple and one theme, so what you'll see is a collection of links that point you at a variety of mapping, a variety of web pages that show maps.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Scott. Go ahead,
Scott. I was the one that kind of raised this issue at our last meeting. I had a couple of ideas. You know, I think of how many years ago it was that we started allowing advertising in the Minnesota Hunting Regulation Book that would allow some offset to those printing costs. You know, when I'm hunting in neighboring states, there is a public lands map statewide available at every counter of every convenience store, literally statewide, and they use that to promote the use of their natural resources. Has anybody considered using advertising as a cost offset so that these maps could be updated and printed? And the last concern I had was was, and I did check with some NGOs as to the lands that are being acquired in fee title, somewhere in our appropriation language. I would like those lands, the language to include that those lands would be included on this public recreation information map system, and that we can't go back into old appropriations, but I would strongly encourage the recipients on lands acquired in fee titles with the first four rounds of funding to go back and add those as well. And no NGO that I talked to had any problem with that request. And so is there any way as we move this forward that we can one, include all lands acquired whether from any recipient of an Outdoor Heritage Fund dollar to be included in the map, and then use some more creative funding mechanisms to get those maps more widely distributed. Not, I want, if I'm really aggressive and computer savvy, I can go find the map for the county I want to work in, instead of making it really easy for people to find the work that's being done with Outdoor Heritage Fund money.
Mr. Chair, council members, we're early on in the planning process of this project, and advertisement has been discussed, but we're not far enough in the project to really have a serious discussion about it. And to answer your second question, yes, I believe that the publicly accessible lands that are acquired through LSOHC funds can certainly be put on public access maps. And one of the jobs of the person who is leading this project is to do that coordination.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Scott?
Yes. Do you think, is there any necessity or any benefit to adding the language to our appropriations that say lands acquired in fee title must be part of the PRIM map system to ensure that all public lands are included?
Janelle or Greg, do you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair and members, my only thought is, I mean, if they're going to do it anyways, I don't know that you have to have the language. If DNR is already planning on putting that information down, but it certainly wouldn't hurt to put it in there.
Mr. Chair, council members, what we do now with the walk-in area or walk-in access program, as part of the easement, states that we will be putting the property boundaries on publicly available maps. It just kind of informs them that this is our intent.
Well, with that statement, Mr. Chair, it might be a good idea to put the language in just to make sure that everybody knows that when they get the money for this, that their land, that land will be on the map.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the criteria that we came up with. Like for restoration, it has to be permanently protected before we'll fund it. Could we put that into our application guidelines so everyone knows if you sign up, this is what you get?
Mr. Chair, we can do that on March the 15th.
Okay. Ryan, you had a question.
The traditional PRIM maps are printed PRIM maps, and I'm glad to see that we're moving away from printed maps. It's 20th century. I mean, everyone that I know, when they're navigating, they're using these. And if you're not, it's not necessarily up to the state to subsidize your use if this is the cheaper option. Traditional PRIM maps had federal government lands that are open, public hunting, waterfall production areas, refuges. Is this information that will be included in your system? Because quite honestly, finding where waterfall production areas are is very difficult. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service site is not easy.
Mr. Chair, council members, yes, we have a good relationship with the Fish and Wildlife Service and other government organizations that operate within the state, and we regularly get updates to their land information from their land base, and we have every intention of Actually, our prototypes are fully populated with WPAs.
Well, it'd be great if you were the one-stop shop that had all publicly accessible lands in it, because, well, that's where people assume that they should go, is the DNR website. One comment on the private landowners that are holding land in fee title that has been paid for with public dollars, Nature Conservancy and others. Why couldn't we just put it in a requirement in their work plans that data has to be provided to the DNR for the purpose of placing on publicly available maps?
I think there are a number of ways we can skin the cat. I'm not sure what the best way is, but there are certainly ways to do it. We can put it in our appropriation language that we're going to talk about a little later, you know, an addition that requires that. We can certainly put it in our criteria in the call for requests, so everybody signing up is essentially agreeing to that. I am not sure I know what all the best ways are, but I don't think anybody is going to find fault with finding the best ways and ensuring we do that.
But you'd agree, Mr. Chair, that the council's expectation for those non-government organizations is that we want those lands to be available and accessible to everybody and findable. And the only way that's done is if that information is provided in some open source.
Think, you know, the requirement is that they have to be open for hunting and fishing. So you have to tell somebody it's there to be open for hunting and fishing effectively. So I can't imagine we don't want to find a way, just speaking for myself as one member, but I can't imagine anybody's going to find fault with requiring those getting public dollars for fee acquisition to have them listed.
Ms. Koop has some information that might be helpful.
I just want to remind members that we do collect land data as part of the final report. When land is acquired, entities must file an annual attestation to the conservation value of that property, and it does include locational information. All of that information is mapped to by the LCC GIS services here, so that information currently is available once the land is acquired.
Once it's acquired, okay. Ryan?
Mr. Chair, maybe you answered this already. Are public boat access is going to be included in this online information, and trout stream accesses, again, some of those provided by this council?
Mr. Chair, council members, yes, we have every intention of showing those of boat landings and trout stream easements. Those are already on the existing series of PRIM maps. The one challenge we will have is with private boat landings through that are available at resorts and that sort of thing. But certainly we have all the information for the accesses that the DNR manages and maintains.
Any other questions? Great, thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
I think we're going to go back to item 9, an update on restoration evaluations.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to remind members that this is a statutorily required evaluation that is done on all legacy fund restorations. The statute is in each fund's authorization. We have to present Wade Johnson to the DNR, and he's brought some friends. So.
I did. Thank you, Chair Hartwell and Council, for having me here this morning to talk to you about the Restoration Evaluation Program. I also have with me today two of the site assessors for two of the projects that are outdoor heritage projects that are featured in the fiscal year 12 report. Paul Bakkenstedt with Stantec, Inc., and Jeff Bussey with DNR, well, formerly with DNR Forestry, now DNR Fish and Wildlife, correct? Do you all have the fiscal year 12 report in hand at this point? Okay, good. That is included in your packet.
Looks like this.
I won't be referring to page numbers as much as I would like, because I didn't have a moment to get into the office this morning as I had hoped to make that print.
Why?
But, you know, there were things going on the road. I can't really tell you. Uh-huh. I don't know why. Just a brief summary, some things you may already know about the program, of course, that it was enacted last year, restoration evaluations for Parks and Trails Fund, Clean Water Fund, and Outdoor Heritage Fund, up to 10 projects per year and up to 0.1% of annual receipts for those funds going to this program. And early this year, I came on as coordinator, and the program began in earnest in April of this year. The restoration evaluation panel was seated with the appropriate membership as dictated in statute, that being a member from the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Greg Larson is holding that position, a member from the DNR, Chris Weir-Ketter from DNR Parks and Trails, a member from the University of Minnesota, Dr. Sue Gladowich, a member from, two members from other organizations with expertise in the field, Greg Hoke from Minnesota DNR Fish and Wildlife, and Greg Berg from Stearns County SWCD. Also, our federal member, Mark Oja, the state wildlife biologist for USDA NRCS, are holding those positions. In terms of the Outdoor Heritage Fund restoration evaluation requirement, that is the responsibility of both the Department of Natural Resources and the Board of Water and Soil Resources. So I am representing both of those agencies in terms of fulfilling that requirement for Outdoor Heritage Fund projects. This field season, 2012, there were 6 Outdoor Heritage Fund projects that were actually field assessed, and that number, it was dictated in a proportionate way to the amount of funding coming into the program for fiscal year 12, and also dictated by how much we could feasibly get done for all of those funds within the field season of 2012 and get that turned around in time to appear in this report. The 3 of those appear in this fiscal year 12 report. 3 of those will be featured in the fiscal year 13 report coming up sometime this next spring. As you'll see, if you read the summary of that report, essentially, as we were dictated in statute to evaluate the projects relative to the law, current science, and the stated goals of the given project, all of the projects are fulfilling the requirement as we see it in terms of the law or appropriation law for any one of those funds and reporting requirements therein. I'm just going to give some broad statements now about projects, and we can talk more about specifics. In terms of fulfilling the requirement for evaluating them relative to current science, they all applied current best practices in what they were doing on the ground, and they were all on a very reasonable trajectory to meet stated goals that they had stated in their plans. So check box on those. Further, statute asks the panel to make recommendations on improving future restorations, and to that point, the panel did make some recommendations, and this is across all 3 funds, and it's not directed at any one particular fund, but they were all things the panel considered to be pertinent to improving restoration practice. You know, across all of the legacy funds, but also would certainly apply to approving restoration practice, you know, in the state of Minnesota. And that being just getting more consistent level of basic planning and implementation documentation so that future managers can pick that information up and continue with it with a certain amount of just brief essential information laid out in such a way that anyone can pick it up and interpret what's going on there. Also, restoration training was something that the panel recommended, and that's directed at just everyone in the state feeding back the information from practitioners on the ground of what's working out there in the field and really getting everyone up to speed on what our best practices are, what people are having success with, and how we can best apply that. And then also some recommendation in improving the evaluation process, the one point that makes it into the summary here, which is following up on some of these projects in future years, so we are actually able to track what's going on there. We're only getting a snapshot, of course, at this point, of projects that are maybe only 1 year or 2 years out from initial implementation on the ground. We can reasonably make some assumptions about the trajectory based on what we're seeing right now in terms of the site preparation and what is currently seeding out or what we see on site now, and that's where I lean heavily on my site assessors with expertise in those particular habitat types to make those assessments of the trajectory of this project to meet its goals long term. But it is the recommendation of the panel that we actually do follow up on some of those in coming years so that we're able to learn from what's going on, where our assumptions about their trajectory is appropriate. And again, overall, the projects are indeed meeting their stated goals, and they're on a very reasonable trajectory to get there. It was a great experience to get in the field, to meet project managers, to actually see what's going on the ground with these projects, and see that indeed the funds are being well spent and well implemented on the ground. And at that, I will open it up to the panel for questions about the program.
Jim?
Yeah, Mr. Johnson, I see the cost of this report here was $4,800. I think we appropriated like $80,000 or $90,000. So what happens to the rest of the money?
Sure. The program as it sets, the Outdoor Heritage funding for fiscal year 12 that would feed into this report and the program as a whole up to date since it began spending money this April goes toward administrating the program, my salary to coordinate the program, again, for all three funds. So Outdoor Heritage's piece is proportionate, again, to the amount of funding coming into the program. This year it would be 26%. Is the amount coming out of that for my salary. There is a small amount in direct and necessary costs, you know, for administering the program, a certain amount. And again, I guess I will make this directly towards Outdoor Heritage because the budgets that I juggle essentially are those three funds all coming into the same program, Outdoor Heritage being 26% of that for this year. And to date, we've only used just under half of the appropriation for fiscal year 12. That was $42,000. And that is starting in April of this year when money began to be spent on that. And it's the assumption that moving forward that we'll be able to appropriately use those funds to follow up on projects. And indeed, given more lead time, we would have time to solicit potentially more field assessors to be involved in this process. Plus, this year, given time constraints, we only looked at a handful of projects, much less than the 10, up to 10, that are directed in statute. Does that answer your question?
No, but I'm good.
Mr. Chair,
to this point, what Jim's asking, Mr. Johnson, the $4,800 is the cost. Mm-hmm. We require in law that reports say how much they cost to be generated.
Correct.
The $4,800 is the cost to generate the report. It's not the cost of the program.
Correct.
Yeah, so it's... I think Mr. Cox's question was
directly about the cost of the report. Based on my best information within the department about how that number is generated per report, it's literally staff time that goes into generating that report and any costs that are directly related to the report production.
So what do you want us to do with this?
Well, I would say that... take this as the first step in understanding how we're beginning to develop an evaluation process for looking at on-the-ground work for legacy projects, including Outdoor Heritage. And I certainly would welcome feedback from any of the council members, and I look forward to legislative eyes looking across this in coming months and seeing how they view what we've done to date in terms of effectively fulfilling the intent of statute for evaluating on-the-ground restoration work. And I would say take a look. At least it's a brief statement, really, of the Outdoor Heritage Fund projects. In the appendices, the actual field evaluation forms give a little bit more detail specifically about the work being done there. And there's certainly some information to be garnered.
Denny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I think what's really valuable is for folks to learn. The evaluations told us some really valuable things. Specifically, there's one in there about the effect of tree shelters and how effective they are and how sometimes some of the practices we're using aren't working. So not only for us to know, but really it's more valuable, I would say, for the people on the ground to look and see what these are. So that's just a comment. I have one question. I thought there was an evaluation done of a project on Whitefish Lake on the restoration on those islands. Is that not in 2012? Was that an earlier one, or is that a future one?
Of the six Outdoor Heritage Fund projects that were looked at, three of them appear in this fiscal year 12 report, and we're front-loading essentially the field evaluations prior to the fiscal year report coming out. And this year we sort of had to lump fiscal year 12 and 13 into one season. So three of those projects, one of those being the Raleigh-Johnson Island joint powers on Upper Whitefish Lake, will appear in the fiscal year 13 report.
A follow-up to that, is that evaluation done? Is there a way to look at it, or it's going to be done?
I would be happy to provide you the information that I have on that to date. Essentially, as the process works, the site assessor, in this case it was Heather Baird with DNR Fisheries and Brainerd office, that was the site assessor of record, and she has months ago now given me her field evaluations, and I distributed that to the Raleigh-Johnson Island Joint Powers representatives, and we've discussed exactly what we saw and what she had seen and is reporting in that field evaluation. In an upcoming meeting of the Restoration Evaluation Panel, that is one of the projects that we will review, and at that point the panel will review that project, and then I will get that into form for the fiscal year 13 report. I'd be happy to give you what we have to date. I don't think there's any real anything holding me back from openly distributing information that we have.
Is it an outdoor heritage funding, or was it clean water?
That is an outdoor heritage CPL grant.
If I can follow up, what did you consider it a success, or did you see problems with it? I'm just curious because I'm familiar with it.
Well, again, this is purely off the cuff, and this has not been reviewed again by anyone else besides what's coming from me right now. I would say that the project overall is a great success in stabilizing many of the shorelines around that island, and I think it was money well spent in terms of leveraging funds from the local groups there, and a lot of the money and sweat equity that they put into it. I think that some of their stabilization, some of the toe stabilization, again, I'm getting into technical details here, have a threat of being dislodged by ice jams and ice jacking this winter. That's my concern based on previous shoreline work. So time will tell whether or not every piece of their stabilization will hold. I would say overall what they have done on the slopes is very, very successful.
Wes?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, early in the funding cycle several years ago, we had quite given discussions on restoration and the value of restoration, the time of restoration. Generally, a good restoration and a bad restoration is about 4 or 5 years. Especially on the WMAs, with the return of the prickly ash and the buckthorn and the invasives. What is your plan to follow up after a period of time looking at the restorations? It's an area that I'd like to see the small grants programs emphasize, as far as letting some of the smaller clubs take the ownership of adopted WMA. The initial restoration is very time-consuming, difficult when you're dealing with some heavy invasive cover. But after that, it becomes a less of an intensive effort. Is there follow-up restorations that are going to be performed
periodically. What is your plan on that?
For following up on some of the evaluations that we had done?
Mm-hmm.
That is our intent, and that was the final recommendation that appeared in the report, which was we're only getting a snapshot, like you say, of the initial phases right now, given that these are only a few years out. And there is, I think, a great amount of value in being able to see these projects 2 years, 4 years, 8 years, 10 years out to understand exactly how that system, you know, has interacted with the you know, the on-the-ground implementation of the initial project and how maintenance practices have either steered or have steered it one way or the other in future years. So I think that there's incredible value in following up on those, and I think we have intention right now to select a handful of projects that we think that the panel considers there being the most value. Certainly any of them will have value in following up in years, but we're going to select a subset to follow up in coming years that they think will have the most value in understanding the dynamics of that particular system or particular habitat type. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Great. Brian.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, on the council, we spend a lot of time on conflicts of interest. We report at the beginning of every meeting conflicts of interest. And it strikes me that the folks that are on the evaluation panels and are doing the evaluating are field staff and employees of the same agencies that receive the bulk of the funding from these sources. Could you talk to me how you deal with perceived and real conflicts of interest within your agencies?
Sure. Well, of course, that's always a concern, and it's one that's at the forefront of our minds. Literally, the membership of the panel and what their affiliation is directed in statute. One DNR, one Bowser, one U of M or Minsky, two others with certain amount of expertise, and then one optional federal or LGU member. And at that point, one of our optional wildcard members is a DNR member, and that was, again, to get the right set of expertise and the right mix of people on that panel. Other than that, it's directed in statute, so you know our hands are held in terms of what their affiliation is. In terms of conflict of interest, I will say that at least in terms of the panel, they are, I think, both on record and in practice, all very impartial of their views, so some of them very much so, and that is not necessarily directed by their employment affiliation or the department that they work for. And then I think that probably one of the most important pieces in terms of conflict of interest is the actual site assessors on the ground and whether or not if we're looking at DNR projects, for instance. I make a point of hiring out contractors. In this case, I had Paul Bockenstedt, who is a private contractor with the right expertise in prairie restoration, to actually go out in the field and look at DNR projects. And to the extent possible, we're very cognizant of conflict of interest and, you know, avoid any real or perceived conflicts. And I would say, in my experience to date, it would very much be a perceived conflict rather than any real conflict. I avoid that administratively in any way possible. Flip side being the people with the right expertise and that right geographic region almost inevitably have some affiliation or past experience with some of the groups or the projects or the area or the land being worked on. And I found that to be the case across the board, where sometimes it was difficult for me. Say, for instance, Jeff Bussey here worked on a project on the North Shore on forestry, and the projects were actually implemented by TNC, but they were under this larger Manitou and Sand Lake Seven Beavers collaboratives, where all of the county and state and federal representatives were actually part of this collaborative, DNR being one. And as I winnowed through the list of trying to find the right people with the right set of expertise in forestry and the North Shore, it seemed like everyone had a little, had some affiliation with those collaboratives, so it wasn't almost, seemed maybe not impossible, but difficult to find someone that didn't have some, you know, affiliation with some of the work being done there. But again, I try to avoid it in so far as it's possible, I do.
So, in summary, so that is a consideration when you're selecting individual evaluators. You're, someone who's implemented a project isn't on the evaluation panel. It's
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And in the case of, and this did actually come up with the Clean Water Fund project, Greg Berg from Stearns County Soil and Water Conservation District is one of the panel members, and an appropriation of Clean Water Fund to Stearns County SWCD came up as one of our projects this year, and so we do formally recuse them of comment on those particular projects that they would have a direct link to.
My major concern is that an evaluator would feel, whether overt or internal, pressure to not negatively evaluate a proposal because it may affect future funding at some point. That's a concern, and I don't know how to get around it. I just want it to be out in the open and on the table.
It's a really valid concern, and certainly one that we have in mind. And I guess, you know, all I can say is to tell you that the group that represents the evaluation panel are, I think they are a very open and honest bunch, and if there were anything that they considered to be duplicitous in the way something was being evaluated, they would have no hesitation to, you know, call that out directly. In fact, we've all been very open, I think, about where the potential for conflict of interest comes in.
Bill?
Let me just make sure I've got this straight. There, you recognize that there could be conflicts of interest, but you have no procedure to identify and allow individuals to recuse themselves. Is that right?
Well, we do, and I'll say that it's on record that both Greg Berg, a panel member involved with Stearns County SWCD with the Clean Water Fund appropriation, and Chris Weir-Ketter from DNR Parks and Trails are formally recused from comment on Chris on Parks and Trails projects, and Greg for the particular Clean Water Appropriation.
Would you send me a copy of your procedures?
Certainly. It's not very formalized, but I will send
it. I'm guessing it's not.
Maybe it should be.
I certainly.
What would you do if the positions or affiliations of the members of the review team were not stipulated in statute? Would you find experts in neighboring states or something like that?
That's a really good question. And given that it's been handed to us, it's one that I haven't considered much. You know, the way that I see it and the way that I see this group coming together with the set of expertise specific to the state of Minnesota and its different regions, I think that the group we have is pretty optimal given any set of circumstances, whether it's being directed or not. I guess that's all I can say to that front. I don't know. I wouldn't really want to have people from out of state coming in to be a part of the Minnesota legacy evaluations.
So the statutes don't affect what you do.
The statutes.
You would pick the same people with or without the
statute. Well, again, I like I say, it's nothing I've given much consideration to, but I would say that they are as good of a group as I think that we could come together with in the state of Minnesota with a certain breadth of expertise, whether or not it was dictated in statute or not.
Some people thought that the evaluations would be done by people at one or more of the universities. Did you consider that at all, and was it the statutes that kept you from doing it? Or?
No. If there were faculty or staff at the university system that were the right people in the right place for a particular project, I wouldn't hesitate to bring them in. It has not happened to date.
Jane, you had a question?
I really appreciate the report, and the findings are encouraging. And I'm just trying to make it a more life-filled exercise. I get you know, all these reports. If there was something that we could do to be more participatory in the process, like notify when a review is going to be in your neighborhood, and if we could stay out of the way, you know, it would, for me, it would be really interesting to, you know, get feet on the ground more frequently than we do. And I'm just wondering if there's any kind of a, you know, nexus here to do that.
Well, I certainly think there's opportunities.
No, get the reports as they're done, you know, so that you can kind of digest them without having to come here and go, you know, through all of this. It's less digestible this way, I think, and it's less real.
Chair and council members, I believe that this is a really good point, and I think that there is opportunity there. This year, I think to date, and what's coming out in this report is very much directed at fulfilling the letter of the law and statute, and I do believe that there certainly is opportunity for, you know, having a little bit more, maybe lively isn't the right word, but a little bit more interactive process, and actually having more people in the field. And I'm planning to do more of that, and actually getting the panel out into the field more this coming year, as I'm able to plan and schedule things farther in advance. This year was very much a, as soon as possible, I can get the right people there and get the project managers on the ground situation. I think that there will be an opportunity for getting some of this information out in other formats. I mean, again, I'm not going to drift the mission of this program too much, but I think there's an opportunity for getting some of the vital information that we're learning from field practitioners fed back out there in a more palatable form than what you see in the legislative report. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there. And then in terms of getting, if the council members would like to be informed when field evaluations for outdoor heritage projects are happening, excuse me, I can certainly make that happen in this coming year, and I would invite anyone to be on board as long as they understood
this. These are measurable moments of the success of the whole, you know.
So I'd like to just suggest that somehow you coordinate with staff so that if any member wants to go out, that's made known to staff, and then staff can coordinate with you to ensure the connection's made. We have time for one more question, Ron.
Mr. Jensen, maybe you partially answered this. How do you go about selecting which projects you're going to review? I'm assuming you're not going to try to review them all. Is it a random process, or how do you go about that?
Well, it's what would be called a random stratified process, insofar as we take all of the projects and I sort of weight them by, and this year again we had the intention to have a good sampling both geographically throughout the state and of different habitat types. So for instance, Outdoor Heritage Fund restoration projects were all put, you know, on a list, and then I categorized them by habitat type, and then I basically took the proportionate number of the different habitat types and said, okay, again, this year we had a very limited number, so, you know, this stratification only went so far. But it made a point of getting a representative project from each one of the habitat types, and once they were in that strata, say, of a wetlands project or aquatic project or, you know, a prairie grassland project, then they would be randomly sampled at that point.
Very quick, because we need to move on or we'll get late here.
We're presently involved in a major restoration over several years, and we work very closely with the DNR wildlife manager in our area. Are you working with these managers to get the feedback and maybe cover more ground than just having your team going out and doing the evaluations?
To actually garner feedback more from the project managers? I am making an attempt at doing that, and I'm hoping to refine that to improve, actually, in that
in that particular way this coming year. This year it was mostly we interacted with whoever the defined project manager was of a particular project. Say, for instance, when I had to call out to Tatley WMA for one of the DNR's prairie grassland projects, the staff there, you know, we had interaction with them. That would be the Marshall Wildlife Office about their project, and actually were garnering direct feedback from them about how they were managing different situations. And honestly, I think for me that was one of the most fulfilling things, is to see that interaction between some of the site assessors with real expertise and the, you know, the project managers of that project with their expertise, you know, in that area as well, having that discourse about, you know, what was working where and what they saw in different places that was really, you know, functional. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's something that I would really like to improve on in the future, to find a better way to really keep that feedback loop going and find some real added value to us going out to do these evaluations.
One comment, the methodology, we're pulling some new furrows here as far as control of some of these invasive species. I think that feedback is going to be important. What herbicide works best, what frequency, application timing, and things like that. Mm-hmm. That's going to be valuable information shared with the different agencies that are involved in this and the different private sectors.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Hartwell, and thank you, council members. Thank you to my...
So next we're going to get a November financial forecast update. Michelle Mitchell is going to give us a... How much money do we have?
Ms. Mitchell is our executive budget officer and advises us on finances of the fund.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the council, my name is Michelle Mitchell, as Bill Becker just indicated. I'm the Executive Budget Officer for the Natural Resources and Environment Area in Minnesota Management and Budget. I'm here to provide an update on the Outdoor Heritage Fund as a result of the November forecast. So the forecast is basically made up of two parts, the general fund statement, which was released last week, and the consolidated fund statement, which is currently being developed. And the legacy funds are part of that consolidated fund statement. So today I'll walk through the projected sales tax receipts and about an estimate of how much money will be available to appropriate. So overall, sales tax receipts are higher than the end of session fund statements. I put together a one-pager that was just handed out. It has two boxes on it. I'll walk through that in a minute. But before I do, I want to talk about the importance of reserves. Keeping money on the bottom line of a fund protects it against forecast risk and cash flow concerns. So, as you know, sales tax is the primary source of funds for the legacy funds, and it's tied to the economy. Any downturn in the economy could negatively impact sales tax receipts and thereby could put the fund at risk. And a related concern is cash flow. By having a reserve on the bottom line, it ensures that any obligations can be covered at the time that it's needed. So generally, MMB recommends between 5 and 10% of projected revenues, estimated receipts, be kept on the bottom line as an unobligated balance. And ultimately, it is up to the council as to how much will be left on the bottom line. So at this time, let's turn over to the one-pager. It's the sheet that has two boxes, 5% and 10%. And this one-pager reflects the amount that can be appropriated over 5% and 10% reserve. So the calculation is fairly straightforward. Adding together the carry forward from the prior year and the estimated sales tax receipts, you come up with the total amount of resources. Next, multiply the unobligated, or to get the unobligated balance, multiply the estimated receipts by, in this case, 5%. I'll work out that box. To get roughly $4.7 million. So to get the total amount available to appropriate, you subtract the unobligated balance from the total resources. So under a 5% reserve, you can see that it's estimated that the council's current recommendation of $92 million allows a 5% reserve for the fund. What's critical to note is that there are a couple fairly large unknowns. The first is that the carry forward amount for fiscal year 13 is still being developed at this time. As I mentioned before, the consolidated fund statement has not yet been released, and we'll have an updated number at that point. The other large unknown is the possible impact of the federal deficit. If the country goes over the fiscal cliff, the state economists predict that the economy will go into recession, and that may negatively impact sales tax receipts. So in conclusion, as I previously mentioned, MMB recommends between 5 and 10%, and the 5% is in line with the council's current recommendations. So with that, I will open it up to any questions you may have.
So I just have one clarifying question. You talked about knowing when the carry forward amount was available and there will be a report released. When is that going to happen?
I believe within the next couple of weeks, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Another question that I have, when I read the forecast, it indicated that the receipts for sales tax were expected to go up 1.6% in this fiscal year and 1.1% in next fiscal year. But I don't see that reflected in your forecast. It doesn't look to me like you've taken this year's forecast into consideration, only next year's increase. Is that right or wrong?
Mr. Chair, the increase included in the one pager that I handed out, that's just an estimate of a 5% reserve. So that amount is taken into account in this calculation.
Both fiscal year 13 and 14's increases based on the forecast.
Mr. Chair, this is reflective of fiscal year 14, to get to your point.
So what about 13?
Mr. Chair, fiscal year 13 would be included as part of that carry forward number, which we will have better estimates on within a couple of
weeks. I'm not sure I agree with you, because the 1.6% would be $1.5 million, and we didn't start the carry forward with $1.5 million, which would be way under the 5%. So I don't know that I think it does include the 13 additional money. And I'm wondering how you would have not been screaming at us if we had only had $1.5 million left over in our appropriation recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I would have strong concerns if you only had $1.5 million on the bottom line of the fund. However, these are the best estimates that I have at this point. I disagree that the increase in sales tax receipts is not included in this number. However, I will have better information for the council, hopefully within a couple of weeks.
Okay. Other questions? Our treasurer, do you know what?
When does the forecast revert and turn into actual?
Mr. Chair, members of the council, actuals occur on a fiscal year, so the end of fiscal year 12 just occurred at the end of June in this year. But I don't believe I'm answering your question. Could you clarify?
That's as close as I can clarify.
Mr. Chair, I believe the answer to the question is that the December consolidated fund statement will have actuals through FY12.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. Thank you.
Wayne?
Sorry. You know, I didn't do real good in my accounting class, I remember way back when, so I'm going to need a real simplified explanation. We've got, we're recommending that we maintain or have as a carryover 5 to 10%. Mm-hmm. So what is that dollar value that we should be carrying over, and how much do we have now?
Mr. Chair, members of the council, the 5% unobligated balance would be for that fiscal year's receipts. So in this, on the one pager, in that 5% box, the estimated receipts are $93.9 million. 5% of that then would be the $4.65 million. That's the amount that MMB would recommend anywhere from that amount to $9.391 million be left on the bottom line. Currently, I don't have an updated amount or estimate as to what the true amount on the bottom line of the fund is at this time, at this date.
So it would be very difficult to, well, I'm just trying to think this out. If the next meeting isn't until March, and we're working with the appropriation language today, how would you go about if we ended up finding we're at 11%? How do you go and get that taken care of at the last minute?
There are a couple of options. One is to do nothing and have a larger balance to give away next year or to appropriate next year. The other is to call a special meeting and make a recommendation to the legislature to amend the bill that we've already passed off to them, which they can either listen carefully to or not.
Thank you.
Other questions? Scott, do you have any questions?
No, I've been following along, though.
All right. All right. Thank you. We look forward to getting real numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, before we get to the next item, which is the appropriation bill, I did want to call your attention to, I think you were all sent an email from the DNR that McGregor Marsh, they have withdrawn the application, which was a $1.75 million allocation that we had moved forward and is in the bill we're going to look at today. So if we take the information that you just got, which essentially based on the recommendation says that our appropriation of $92 million is in the ballpark for 5%, you have to add $1.75 million to that, and we're going to have to amend the appropriation language to take that out, since they no longer feel they can do the project.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
At an appropriate point in time, Ms. Koop is prepared to give you an overview of the bill.
Okay. Just before we get there, are there any questions about McGregor Marsh? And
I'd like to move to on the amendment to delete it from the bill when we get there, because I thought so hard to get it in originally. So
we'll give you that opportunity.
I want to kill it, too.
We'll give you that opportunity. Heather, do you want to help us?
Would you like me to go over the bill, sir?
That's the help I was looking for. Sorry.
Okay. The analysis that was done in the bill was done prior to our knowing that the McGregor Marsh project was being suspended. So please take that into account with the following analysis. The council had recommended, as you all know, 30 projects totaling $92 million. We had a variety of entities applying for funds and successfully being recommended.
Okay. Would you direct their attention?
Oh, I'm sorry. Handout, yes, the handout is a color two-page FY14 Outdoor Heritage Fund recommendation summary draft in your packet. So organizations recommended to receive funding include two watershed districts, two counties, two state agencies, and nine NGOs, many of whom have applied and received funds in the past. 76% of the proposals are continuations of previously funded programs. As you are aware, the council has, for the majority of its funding, recommended programmatic initiatives. So you'll see several entities for which we have given funds in the past, including Dakota County, Ducks Unlimited through their Living Shallow Lakes and Wetlands Initiative, and the Moose Habitat Program, along with the acceleration of the WMA, WPA, and AMA programs. One nice thing that we're seeing throughout the course of the last 4 years is collaborations and partnerships among different entities, and this year we recommended 36% of the programs involve partnerships of one or more organizations. As in years past, the majority of activity is an enhancement, over 73,000 acres, and of course, the enhancement activity incurs no PILT liability. And again, many of these programs are familiar to the council, the programs that we funded in the past, including the DNR's Grassland Habitat and Restoration Project, the Minnesota Prairie Recovery Project as well. The majority of funding, however, is in fee acquisition, as logic would stand, over $37 million, the majority of which will be taking place, again, in the Prairie region of the state. Easement acquisition totals over $27 million, and of that amount, over 45% is going to the RIM WRP program in a Phase 5 effort. One nice thing, of course, about the RIM program is it leverages a lot of federal money, and almost $20 million in federal funds will be coming to the state to enhance that program. Conservation work in the prairie and the forest prairie transition area constitutes 74% of the activity and 62% of the funds. PILT obligations are created with 37% of overall PROTECT activity, and that of course includes lands being acquired with PILT, without PILT, and through easement, 65% of which that total is in fee acquisition. One additional measure that we ask project managers to offer is the number of feet or miles of shoreline being affected. In this year's bill, we have 174 miles of shoreland that will be affected. One other item I'd like to draw the council's attention to is the amount of money going to the metro urbanizing area. And this year, we have over 14% of the total $92 million across nine different programs. The following two pages illustrates in a table and pie chart format how the money is being allocated, as well as the number of acres and a variety of both habitat types and across the state's geographic area. You can take some time to take a look at that. On the last page of this handout, we did an analysis of the payment in lieu of taxes. Wanted to point out a couple of things. The number of acres acquired with PILT liability is 6,737. Without, it's about half that amount, a little over 3,000 acres. Over 12,500 acres are being permanently conserved through a conservation easement. The estimated value of all of these lands with accruing PILT liabilities over $24 million, and the annual PILT obligation of the state is $181,789, which is a bit lower than what we have incurred over the last several years. But it's hovered a little bit under $200,000 in annual obligations. Personnel associated with these recommendations, over $6 million of the total 92 is directed toward personnel, which is about 6.5% of total recommendations. Of those dollars spent, 45.65 FTEs will be created, 26.83 in state positions and state agencies, and 18.82 in NGO positions. Additional jobs will be created as well with the money going into local economies. We will once again work with University of Minnesota Duluth Labowitz School of Business to do an in-plan analysis of what that economic impact will be of the $92 million recommended. Finally, of the total of the $6 million being spent for personnel, but $3.8 million will be going to state agencies and $2.2 will be going to NGOs. I will stand for questions regarding this analysis or any other questions the council might have about the bill or the recommendations.
Sorry, we have a member who is caught in traffic wondering how to call in. We're working through that detail. That's why I wasn't paying attention. Bill, you had a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you could, we're near into the fifth year, I guess it's the fourth year worth of acquisition. The PILT payment has been X amount per year. Do you know what the average has been so far? Good information. Maybe you can get that to me later.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the annual amount has been below $200,000 a year for each year's bill, but I can get you the exact figures as well.
I know there's still a study, I believe, going on with regards to the PILT payment. I don't know if any of you have been involved in that at all. It's still going on.
so I think that'd be useful information for that particular group as well. So if you can get that to me, that'd be great. Thanks.
Jane?
Is there anything here that really stood out in your mind as being different this year as opposed to this history?
Mr. Chair, Councilmember Kingston, no. I think one of the things that I find is that the recommendations have been fairly similar from year to year in terms of the regions in which we're making investments, the number of acres being worked on. One thing that has changed as the programs have evolved is the number of partnerships. That has increased over years. But otherwise, nothing particularly stands out.
Thank you.
So, members, before we go much further, Tom Saxhog is caught in traffic and feels very strongly that he'd like to be part of the final discussion and vote on this. So we're going to try to hook him in by conference call. Sandy needs to do some magic to make that work because the way Scott is connected in is a one-on-one, not a conference call. So we're going to take a 10-minute recess while she works that out. And come back to discuss this at 10 o'clock. Park and walk in here. So we don't have him on the phone now. But we're going to get moving anyhow because we just don't know how long it'll take him to get here. So I think where we find ourselves, if I can summarize or do as good a job as possible, is the forecast numbers show that with the allocation that is in front of you or the appropriation language that's in front of you, we would be at about a 5% reserve. I will tell you I have some questions as to whether or not the increase that was in the forecast of the 1.6% increase in sales tax revenues for 13 is included in this number, but I don't think we're going to get clarification of that today.
You don't think it's in here?
I do not believe it's in there, but I don't think it would be prudent to just trust me and then allocate the money and then discover that we're making a mistake. We do have a fair degree of uncertainty in terms of the fiscal cliff and what could happen should we actually go over that in terms of recession and sales tax revenues. We do have for sure 1.75, which we can choose to do a number of things with. One is to just add it to the reserves and appropriate it in future years. Given the uncertainty, that might or might not make sense, depending on your individual perspective. We could spread that allocation of the 1.75 around to numerous or all projects. Staff would highly recommend we don't spread it to all projects because every accomplishment plan has to be amended if we did such a thing. We could choose a project we have already funded and add more money to it, or one we haven't funded and add money and give money to it. So there really are four options. Only three, I think, are in any way viable. Do nothing, give money to add money to projects that have already gotten an appropriation and fund something we haven't already funded. So, yes.
When appropriate, I would like an opportunity to speak.
Okay. Let me just say at this point I want to open it up to all members for discussion. First, I'd like to have a discussion just generally before we get to any specific motions so that we can have a chance for everybody to express themselves as to what would go forth before somebody jumps on it and we then are only focused on that specific motion. So with that, Scott, I'm happy to recognize you.
And this is not being made in the form of a motion, but an item that can be brought up for council discussion. Last meeting, when we allocated all of the unused funds and came to our current appropriation, the first 11 of those motions used unallocated funds that were left kind of on the side, okay? Of those, 10 passed, one did not. I was the 12th council member to make a motion, and my motion, which passed, was the only motion that had to take money from an existing recipient and reduce that appropriation in order to fund the pilot program Grasslands for the Future. And I think because the 12th motion was the only motion that actually removed funds from a successful recipient, which was $2 million from RIM-WRP, I think it would be prudent for the council to take this 1.7 of now available funds and restore that appropriation that was in theory robbed or otherwise reduced at the last meeting. So I think we should consider restoring RIM-WRP's funding with the $1.7 million that exists from the McGregor Marsh project.
Okay. Let me just, as I'm sitting here, I'd like to have the council focus first on, do they want to spend or keep the money in reserve, the 1.75, as a point to start with? Because I think it's important that we understand what level of reserves we want to target before we allocate. And Scott, with all respect to you, if you don't mind, we move back to something that you're suggesting or others will, and first talk specifically about how we feel about a level of reserves.
Can I, and I'll respond to that, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
We have always had a 5% reserve, approximately. I think that that level of reserve is adequate with the understanding that our projects don't all get funded in the year, that all the money does not get used in the year that the allocation is received. So I'm very confident with the 5% reserve, and would make a my intent would be then to reallocate this 1.7. That's my personal opinion.
Okay. Other thoughts on level of reserve, less than
I think rather than advocate our responsibility, I think we should stick with the 5% and make that allocation of the additional funds that are returned.
Okay. Wayne?
First of all, I know that we have somebody who would like to make a motion to take that off the bill to start with the 1.75. So that we know, but that we actually have that to work with. And then at that point, I'm even thinking that going along with what Scott was talking about, maybe we want to spend part of it and keep part of it. And since RIM-WRP is one of those that's fluent and flexible, give them $1 million and retains 0.75. And therefore, we kind of do justice to both our carryover and take care of that problem.
Okay. Jane?
In addition to the McGregor Marsh dollars, why wouldn't we look at this 248 that we are given as of now?
It's completely up to us.
So, I mean, I'm still addressing what you're saying is how much is there and what are we going to do with it?
Yeah. So you're suggesting that there's really $2 million, not 1.75.
Correct.
Okay. Ryan?
I agree that we should spend the 1.75 million. I agreed with that. Philosophically, I would like to see that money dedicated to a similar scope project, wild rice or shallow lakes, would be my preference. But as long as I get to move to kill it, then I'm open to everything after that.
Does anyone think we should not spend the money and just keep it in reserve? Chair. Bill, go ahead.
Thank you. Dave, you mentioned the over the cliff. I don't know if this is the right appropriate place to be talking about that, but what are your concerns of that? Let me hear your concerns of that, and if that were the case, I guess I would have a tendency to leave it at the bottom line, but what do you...
I think the concern, whether it's mine or in general, is that if we go over the fiscal cliff and taxes go up, there is a strong likelihood that people will stop spending money. Either they don't have the money or they're fearful they won't have the money. And if people aren't spending money, we're likely to see a recession come back. With a recession, people don't spend money. Sales tax revenues certainly will go down, as will employment and income tax revenues. So the fiscal cliff, to me, is a point where if there's too much automatic tax increase, people stop spending money and put us into recession, which leads to less revenue. Whether or not that's the right assessment, but it certainly is a huge concern that could happen. What do you think?
Well, I don't know if anybody wants to hear what I really think about that, but if we do go back up into a recession, there's no question about it. I think it's prudent on our part, at the very least, to do something similar to what Wayne's talking about, maybe spend half of it and leave the other half in reserves at the most. But boy, I agree. The uncertainty thing is out there, and is the 5% or what 5% means? 5 million, is that what it means, Bill? Exactly on the bottom line. I'm not sure what.
4.9,
yeah,
roughly.
The money has to be allocated. It goes to the bottom line. I mean, that's the bottom line. So it's not that we're going to not do a project. It's going to postpone it for a period of time. And, yeah, we are a yearly allocation. We're not a biannual. So,
Kenny?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two different ways I thought that would be great to spend the money. Scott's is my favorite project, and when it got cut $2 million at the last instance, the rim, I was kind of bummed out because it's got such a great match. The Fond du Lac project could conceivably be resurrected as a WMA, and it fits with Commissioner Landwehr's request. But I guess, Chairman, I would ask, I'm thinking that we really shouldn't spend it, that it might be the right idea to leave it on the bottom line and come back in March. Maybe we have a discussion today about what this council thinks it's the right thing to do with the money. I think a good discussion about additional RIM or the Fond du Lac project, but actually not spend it and make a recommendation when we come back. And I think we could schedule a meeting. And when I say we, I feel pretty strongly it won't include me, but the board, the commission will then be able to meet and maybe make a recommendation to the legislature, because sometime by February, at least by March, when our meeting is, we'll probably know if the federal legislators came together or not. And I just think if we allocate it and then we end up falling off and then we lose a bunch of money, it'll be a bigger hassle. The other thing is, Mr. Chair, you asked a question and she never did answer it. I actually think the money is understated. I think MMB is being protective here because she never really answered. She said she'd get back to you, which led me to believe, well, that's like her making her own cushion there, which I don't know if was appropriate or not. And I saw the look on your face that, unfortunately, that didn't show up on the tape. But I think I'm not sure that we really get the right idea here. But that would just give us more protection to be able to. And I've always been an advocate that I think this council should keep more flexibility during session, because the legislature, I'd rather them not get creative on their own. I think this group should have input in that. So I guess I would be inclined to not spend it at this point, but have a discussion about where potentially it could be spent in the future.
Any other sort of general comments before I open it up for motions and action, and we can have discussions? Jane?
Just another conceptual, you know, reflection on what we allocated thus far and having the money that's here now. When we made the allocations that are in the packet and the language now, there were two projects that fell above the cutoff line. Everything else was funded above the line, and there were two that were not. And that would be another two targeted projects that had made the original criteria type of cutoff that fall above the line that could be ripe for money, too. Of course, for the future and protecting the St. Louis River watershed, the Fond du Lac project, those two.
Just a clarification.
So just a conceptual look.
There were three. One was Goose Lake Restoration, but that got a partner's grant. So
yeah, so they're not on the table.
Yeah.
Now.
Okay.
They've already been funded. Yeah, they were funded.
Yeah. So with that, I guess Ryan, you wanted to make the motion to approve the appropriation, but take out that project. If you can put that motion on the floor, then we can have a series of motions and or amendments. And are you suggesting I do something different?
I can suggest to Mr. Bradson.
I was going to move the bill and then move an amendment.
Yeah, it's 4E that you want to take out.
Okay, Ryan.
Well, I would move to place the LaSalle San Beltra Heritage Council draft bill on the table.
Okay.
And I would move to amend that document by deleting section 4E, which is page 6, lines 23 through 33. The McGregor Marsh Wetland Protection Project.
All right. So with that, we would first take a vote on the amendment, which would be to eliminate 4E, the McGregor Marsh. Sandy, do you want to take, are there any discussion on that? Will you take the roll?
Representative Lilly?
Aye.
Representative McNamara?
Aye.
Scott Rall?
Yes.
Senator Saxhog?
Yes.
Ron Shera?
Yes.
Lester Bench?
Yes.
Ryan Bronson?
Aye.
Jim Cox?
Yes.
Wayne Inger?
Yes.
Senator Ingridson?
Yes.
Chair Hartwell?
Yes.
Oh, Jane Kingston.
Oh, yes.
All right, Scott, since you're not here, I'm going to give you at least the opportunity, having heard the comments that people made, to consider whether or not you'd like to make a motion for consideration.
Very much would like to, Mr. Chair. And after having listened to the comments of the council, I would like to make a motion that we add $1 million of the available revenue to RIM-WRP and leave the remaining $1 million in the cushion for our potential unknown.
Okay. Any discussion? Comments? All right. Sandy, call the roll.
Jim Cox.
Yes.
Wayne Inger.
Yes.
Senator Ingridson.
Yes.
Jane Kingston.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Scott Rall.
Yes.
Senator Saxhog.
Yes.
Ron Shera.
Yes.
Lester Bench.
Yes.
Ryan Bronson.
Aye.
Chair Hartwell.
Yes. So, anyone else want to make motions? I'd like to have a quick discussion on the restoration discussion that we had earlier. We've currently allocated $92 million, which is 1% to that program, the restoration evaluations. The statutory language says that we have to appropriate up or can appropriate up to 1% of our allocation. It does not require a specific amount. Last time through, we appropriated $45,000.
I believe that's correct.
I don't know about you, but I feel like that wasn't the best money we've ever spent. And it didn't point out that there were significant problems in the restoration money that we were spending. So I'd like to recommend in the form of a motion that we reduce the allocation to the $45,000 that we gave last time, which seems to me to be more than adequate to get that kind of a report. Ron?
Well, I think I get your point, but I find these evaluations to be critical. Whether they're doing the good job or the right job with the money, I don't know. But Minnesota, the taxpayers of Minnesota put a lot of confidence in this council, but the proof of the pudding is, have these projects turned out to be what they were supposed to be? And so that evaluation part of it is very, very critical. I was bothered by the point Ryan brought up about the conflict of interest among people looking over each other's shoulders. Maybe we need, or the legislature, I think it's their bill, maybe they need to take another look at the evaluation. I just find the evaluation is very important for people to have confidence in what's going on here.
I guess my question is, do they need more than they've already gotten? Because it seems like what we did was confirm that the work is pretty good work. And so do we need to continue to spend money every year to get that kind of a report that didn't really lead us to new stuff or tell us that we have a problem? It's my own. It's whatever you guys want to do. Denny?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would prefer to see more evaluation. I'm interested specifically in the one on the Whitefish chain. It was really great work done by a lot of volunteers, but it did not have plant material establishment through the vegetative mat. And I'm thinking the evaluation may help us learn from that what maybe didn't get done right, because there was really a lot of that project has volunteers really ginned up and working hard. And I think we can learn some things. I pointed out to Wayne, there's one that talked about the success in the evaluation of tree shelters. So I think these evaluations, spending 1% on of them, I guess I would at this point prefer to see more of them done rather than less. And then going forward, if we're adequate to have less, I think that would be okay. But I'm curious to know on this one, where it looked like really good work done, but maybe the wrong plants were used, or the volunteers didn't realize they had to water them more or something. I'm not sure what it was, but I guess at this point, I would not want to see us spend less.
Okay. Jim?
Well, I'm going to agree with David. If you look at this report, this is from three funds, so I'm assuming the two other funds also gave them close to $100,000. So we spent $300,000 for a report that cost $4,800. I mean, I don't think it's a question of do we want these or need these. I agree we do, but I think we just don't have to throw money at it. And I think that's what we've done. So we've been pretty austere with our administrative budget and how we spend our money. To throw $300,000 at a $4,500 report, I don't think makes a lot of sense. So that's my opinion.
Okay. Sandy, can you call the vote? I'm sorry.
Yep.
Wayne.
Would you please one more time explain your motion, what you were...
My motion is to reduce the amount in the recommended appropriation for restoration evaluation program phase three from $92,000 to $45,000, which is similar to the amount we provided last year.
Mr. Chair, you're moving that on page 11, line 31, delete $92,000 and insert $45,000.
That's exactly what I'm recommending. Thank you.
Chair?
Yes.
Would that leave those unused funds on the bottom line?
Yes, they would.
Thank you for that clarification.
Any other questions? Sandy, if you'll call the roll.
Okay, Les Bench?
Yes.
Ryan Bronson?
Aye.
Jim Cox?
Yes.
Wayne Anger?
Yes.
Senator Ingraton?
Yes.
Jane Kingston?
No.
Representative Lilly?
No.
Representative McNamara?
No.
Scott Rall?
Yes.
Senator Saxhog?
Yes.
Ron Shera?
Yes.
Chair Hartwell?
Yes.
9-3.
So the motion passes. Any other, or the amendment passes, any other amendments to the appropriation, to the motion that Ryan has made? Ryan?
I don't know if this is an amendment, just more discussion. This vote we just took indicates, if this indicates unhappiness with the evaluations, perhaps we should address that with the people involved. And I don't know if it's within our realm to maybe have some of us be either pick some of the places that should be evaluated, leaving, or get more involved with it. I just feel that the evaluation is very, very critical, and it needs to be above board. And I think it's up to us, as well as the legislature, to make sure we do what we can to do that. So if that means, if this vote means we're unhappy with it, then we should bring them in here and solve it.
And if I were a program manager that had money taken away, I think I'd be looking for a discussion about how to be more robust in what I was delivering. That would be how I would read it. Other, Bill?
Can you tell me, the group now, what with the most recent amendment here, what is going to be on the bottom line total? What's the total on the bottom line?
It will
number,
be.
Number. The, is it the 465 plus 248 plus 1 million? Or
plus 750,000. So it would roughly be 5.7 million.
Thank you.
Plus the 45.
Plus the 45.
47.
40,
right.
Yeah.
And there is an outstanding question with regard to new language and the administrative portion, which I'll go over right now.
I think you better.
David?
Yeah.
I think you answered Senator Ingelbritzen that it was 4.695 plus the 1 million. I'm sorry, plus the
750,000 plus the 248, which is the difference.
I thought you said it didn't include the 248.
Yeah, so it's roughly $2 million. It's 4.6 plus 750 plus the 248, which would really leave you at 5.7 in rough terms.
47.
40 plus 40, yeah, the roughly.
And 7.3.
Let's see. Who had a question? Bill, did you have something? Okay.
Bill was trying to explain that.
Oh, Bill was going to. I'm sorry. I got confused.
Councilor Kingston asked about the language and availability of appropriation. What I'd like to do is go over some changes in the administrative section that are new language. And on page 11, on line 17, the sentence beginning with the comprehensive plan must include a copy of the grant contract template reimbursement manual is new. This does not mean that the council has the authority to change or remanufacture those documents. It's for information only. The forming of the executable contract and that sort of thing is an executive branch task. We have that in there because we haven't been given the documents historically. On the Legislative Coordinating Commission, on line 28, funds in this appropriation are available under Minnesota Statutes, section 16A.281, addresses appropriations to the legislature. It just puts the
appropriations to us under the same law that other appropriations from the legislature are under. On page 12, beginning on line 12, the sentence reading for acquisition of real property, the amounts in this section are available until June 30th, 2017. If a binding agreement with the landowner or purchase agreement is entered into by June 30th, 2016 and closed no later than June 30th, 2017. This has been inserted to take into account the problem that Dakota County had on signing a purchase agreement in June and not closing until August, and the Department of Natural Resources not accepting that as a valid expense within the time period of availability. So this clarifies that. And then lastly, on page 12, line 25, this is the belt and suspenders approach. For the purposes of administering appropriations and legislatively authorized agreements paid out of the Atmar Heritage Fund, an expense must be considered reimbursable by the administering agency when the recipient presents the agency with an invoice or binding agreement with the landowner and the recipient attests that the goods have been received or the landowner agreement is binding. And that in part addresses the above, the Dakota County issue, but it also addresses the administration of grants on a cash accounting basis instead of an accrual accounting basis, and in essence puts in the instruction to the department to manage on an accrual accounting basis.
Okay. Does that answer, Jane, your question?
Thank you.
It does occur to me that we had a discussion about the PRIM maps and potentially adding something to our appropriation language, which clarified that land bought in fee with council recommended funds or with legacy funds be listed on the publicly available maps. I'm not saying that right, but everybody knows what I mean. Do you want to leave that as it is with the understanding that that's happening and to some degree put it in next year's recommendations or actually add a section to this that specifies that?
Where would you put it?
Janelle and Greg would tell us where they'd put it. Where would you put it, Greg, if you were going to do that?
Mr. Chair, I would just make it a subdivision 9 and just title it mapping or something to that effect, and then just say that the land acquired in fee title with appropriation under this section be mapped by the Department of Natural Resources with information on what on the that it's open to public taking of game and fish during the open season.
So if someone, Jane, if you'd like to make a motion giving Greg some flexibility to work with Janelle and come up with this specific language to be included, I think we could live with that, to be approved by staff.
I move what you just said.
Any discussion on that?
Guarantee that it's litigation proof.
I wouldn't guarantee anything, Bill.
I would. I'd say that.
All right. So, vote on the amendment. Or, Ron, sorry.
I think it's important that obviously these areas are mapped, but I think it's also important that they're identified. I assume maybe that's what you mean, identified with the legacy amendment, that people know.
We already require signage.
Signage at the site.
At the site.
But in the mapping, or printed maps, or electronic.
That it actually has a note that was provided by the legacy amendment?
Mm. Good idea.
Is that Jane's nodding is an acceptable amendment to her, or addition to her amendment? And Greg will add that friendly amendment. Will you call the roll, Sandy?
Scott Rall.
Yes.
Senator Saxhog.
Yes.
Ron Shera.
Yes.
Lester Bench.
Yes.
Ryan Bronson.
Aye.
J. Jim Cox.
Yes.
Wayne Anger.
Yes.
Senator Ingritson.
Aye.
Jane Kingston.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Chair Hartwell.
Yes. Okay, we're ready to vote. Anyone have anything else they want to add? So we are voting on the appropriation language. Ryan's motion with amendments has passed. Sandy, will you call the roll? Jane?
I just would like to know what the reserve stands at now. What percent is it with all these numbers to add up? 5%? Is it 6%?
It's about 6%.
And that's recognizing the uncertain financial.
Yeah, it's on the low end of the 5 to 10%. It's above the 5%, and it's a safety net.
And it's different this year than it happened in the last four.
A little bit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's financial situations.
Yeah. Everything's different.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Lester Bench.
Yes.
Ryan Bronson.
Yes.
Jim Cox.
Yes.
Wayne Anger.
Yes.
Senator Ingritson.
Yes.
Jane Kingston.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Scott Rall.
Yes.
Senator Saxhog.
Yes.
Ron Shera.
Yes.
David Hartwell.
Yes. We have passed by unanimous vote our package for the 2014 fiscal year. Great work, everybody. It's taken us a while to get here, but a great process. Thank you all.
So we will get this corrected into the reviser and prepare a letter for the chair to submit this to the speaker. Majority leader will print a copy to the governor. And that should come out in the first 2 weeks of January. One of the J months.
Yeah. We had a discussion on the land conservation appraisal workshop.
In November, the one-day workshop was held on land conservation appraisals, and it was sponsored by the Nature Conservancy, Minnesota Land Trust, and Land Trust Alliance. Thank you. Two members of the council attended, Les Bench and Jane Kingston and myself, and as part of the requirement in the council's operating procedures to provide a summary of meetings attended by council members, we thought that this would be an opportunity to fulfill that requirement and having a discussion about the appraisal process and what was learned at that workshop. To that extent, I prepared, I think it's a three-page summary eight pages. Culled from slide presentations that were made that day on the recommendation of Jane and Les. So with that, I will let Jane and Les take it from here.
This is what I thought I came away with, was what was important out of the whole day that we were there. I learned a whole bunch of stuff that made me come away feeling a lot more secure about the appraisal process as it relates to the projects that we do. I was surprised in a lot of circumstances as to what is considered, what should be considered, and what shouldn't be considered. Both of the presenters, I thought, were remarkable in the depth of their knowledge and their experience. And rather than read you back what's on the handout, I don't know if you've all had a chance to read it yet, but I would suggest that we get a condensed form of what was presented on that day and have them come here and have it addressing specifically what our work is here on the council.
If I could add a few things to that. I second the suggestion. Cindy Nathan with the DNR did an excellent job, and Wendy, I left my notes on the other end of the snowstorm, so I don't have my notes, but I'll try to recall. Wendy Walker. But I would highly suggest that we get Cindy for an abbreviated version here in front of the whole council. Some of the things that I learned, I always had trouble with the highest and best use evaluation during appraisal. The highest and best use is really a seller's opportunity. The seller is entitled to the value of the highest use of the property, even though it isn't going to be used in that manner. But it's really an opportunity for the seller. And that kind of alleviated some of my questions on some of the properties that we've approved. One other area that I've always found confusing is present value versus future worth. The present value of the property, if you were to take your lakeshore and lot it off in subdivisions and lots and then do an evaluation on it, there's a question on how quick this lakeshore is going to be developed, and you can look at comparable sales and put a value on the property. The future worth depends on how fast these properties sell, and if it's going to take 2 years, 5 years, 7 years, the value of that property is going to be discounted because of the future value is not going to be worth the present value. In other words, how long does it take to accomplish that sale? And this is a judgment factor. What's the price of gold going to be in 5 years? What's the Dow Jones going to be next year? It's a crystal ball type approach. So it's an inexact science to use this discounted value in appraisals with the present value and the future worth. She mentioned the variation between the assessor and the appraiser. She seemed to think that the assessor was somewhat behind the curve as far as being current. I would probably look at it the other way. The assessor, I think this is county dependent, but I know in Otter Tail County we have a visit from the assessor on a yearly basis and look at all properties that have been changed. The reevaluation is done on a yearly basis. Appraisal comes at the request of the seller many times or the agency that's working for it. So I would say the appraiser and the assessor have to be pretty close as far as an indication of what the value of the property is worth.
And that's not my experience. So, you know, there's a lot of range of difference of opinion there and in actuality.
And if you look at a more of a populated county like Otter Tail versus, say, St. Louis County, that may be the difference. And I think that all has to be kept into consideration. After the sale and the appraisal's off, then I think the seller has the right to go back to the appraiser for a adjustment to the taxation situation. But again, it was a very, very enlightening seminar, and Cindy is excellent. If we have questions in the future, I feel very comfortable in referring to her and answering those questions on appraisals.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for those that attended? If not, last order of business, I think, is if there are any public comments. I don't know of any in advance, but if anybody in the audience wants to address the council, this would be the moment to do so. I see nobody. Any last comments by anyone on the council? If not, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, bye, everybody.
Thanks, Scott.
See you, Scott. Bye, Scott.
All right.